You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me.
I just read a book about a Republican president presiding over a deeply divided nation. And some thought that this president was thought of as a laughingstock around the world. And there was new technology that allowed news to spread at a faster rate than in the past. And the president used this technology as no other leader before him. But the president was alarmed that the news media was disseminating fake news. The president, who is the subject of this book, is Abraham Lincoln. And the book is Lincoln's Lie, a true Civil War caper through fake news, Wall Street, and the White House. And the author is Elizabeth Mitchell, who is my guest. And she's also the author of The Fearless Mrs. Goodwin, How New York's First Female Police Detective Cracked the Crime of the Century, Liberty's Torch, The Great Adventure to Build the Statue of Liberty, The Fire Horse, Three Strides Before the Wire, The Dark and Beautiful World of Horse Racing, and other books. Elizabeth Mitchell, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much for having me.
So Lincoln's Lie is some really great investigative reporting, but how do you investigate a story that happened 150 years ago?
Well, it's a bit tricky. I mean, one thing that's happened is the new digitization of small newspapers has opened up a lot of information we wouldn't have had before. So, you know, this was the era when New York newspapers were probably at their zenith. You know, they were going out across the country, and there were about 15 that were really powerful in New York, but there were, you know, 5,000 something papers across the country. So now we get to see what those reporters were saying. And so it's easier to piece together a story like this.
So you used contemporary newspapers. And what else?
I didn't interview anybody. Yeah, exactly.
I
mean, well, we have access to memoirs that weren't available before, because, you know, there would be, say, one copy of it sitting in Germany or something, and you didn't get access. But because of the now shared records, we can see those. But I mean, I also went to the Library of Congress and looked in the paper archives. I went to the National Archives and went through all the Civil War, you know, both microfilm and regular documents. I contacted archives across the country. So I went to, you know, Columbia's and Princeton's and all these other places. So yeah, it was regular research plus this other digitization.
So the Telegraph was the Twitter of its day.
Yes. I mean, there's amazing quotations from that time. One newspaper editor was lamenting that he was fearful that these public figures had access to the public unmediated and that they could communicate with the American public like lightning, you know? So it was the same sort of struggle, you know, and debate going on about Twitter, you know, what this kind of unmediated ability for people to say basically whatever they want to say. And so that was really interesting to me. And also just the ubiquity of the telegraph. I hadn't quite understood that it wasn't just something that you sent one somber message, but it was something where people were sending messages all day long. Like, you know, if you wanted to change your date from dinner to the theater, you would do it over the telegraph, even if you were living in the same city.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think, you know, people today have completely forgotten telegrams. I mean, they were a thing that happened like crazy for a long
time. Yeah, I mean, it was a big business. And it was also, I mean, there was a lot of discussion about who should control it. And Abraham Lincoln, you know, when he first came in, it certainly had been around for a couple decades, but it wasn't so widely used. So when he started his presidency, he sent maybe one or two a month, because he would have to send a little messenger person down to the telegraph office and stand in line like everyone else. But then they routed all the wires through the War Department, which was right near the White House. And at that point, he basically slept there. I mean, literally, he would go over four or five times a day. And if the news was really, you know, a crucial period in the war or what have you, he would sleep overnight there.
But he couldn't send telegrams while sitting on the toilet. Let's
yeah, that's true. At least that we know of.
So, I mean, it is interesting how many parallels there are to our, you know, we always think of all our current situations as being incredibly unique to us.
Yeah.
But you found a lot of parallels.
Yeah, and in a way, I found it very reassuring because I think we get into this kind of mire where we think, oh, we're the worst that ever existed. You know, we're the most partisan, the, you know, media is out of control, the president's out of control, whatever it is. And the and actually, you know, if we just go back and look at history, we have some real, you know, lessons there. It's the old thing they say, it's true. You know, you can see pathways in how to negotiate the situation so that we can get to some more stability. And I thought, I found that really reassuring.
So there's hope to be found in Lincoln's lie.
There is. I mean, the other thing from both this book and then the book I did about the making of the Statue of Liberty, there's one other side to the story too, but I don't think this is cause for despair, which is that democracy is a very fragile, exotic, you know, rare thing. And so it shouldn't surprise us that we have to constantly work to maintain its health. You know, I mean, you even, you know, maintain your garden, and that's, you know, a lot less complicated than a you know, multi-million numbers of people across the country with different views.
You also wrote about George W. Bush, and during George W. Bush's term in office, a lot of people thought this was the most divided we've ever been. This is the worst situation we've ever been in.
Yeah.
Of course, yeah. A lot of those same people would now embrace George W. Bush.
No, I know. It's very interesting. And so, I mean, even in that instance, when I was writing about him, I wrote about him when he was up for the Republican nomination, and I thought he was likely to win the nomination and go on to the presidency. I had come off of being the executive editor of George magazine, so I had been paying a lot of attention to politics. And one thing I was trying to do there was to take a look at him as a figure matching up to his father's political career and see what he was doing in each of those moments. And so I think often if you put things in context, it gives you a lot more just, you know, it takes the kind of just pure fear factor out of many situations, I would say.
Yeah. When you're working at George magazine, that was John F. Kennedy Jr.'s magazine, right?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah. So I went over there before the launch, you know, when he was just setting up the magazine as a senior editor, and then I became his executive editor about 6 months in.
Well, then, you know, we have to ask, how did you find JFK Jr.?
Well, he was a wonderful person. He was a good friend of mine, as well as my boss. And it was a kind of, you know, it was just a wonderful adventure because he was so enthusiastic about the project and the idea of bringing people into politics who hadn't known that they could have a view or get, you know, get the information they needed. So it was really wonderful to see it take off the way it did. And, you know, also we had 50% female readership, which was completely unheard of for a political magazine. And that was something, you know, important we felt for like the dialogue going forward. And he was funny and he was fun and we miss him terribly.
It's hard to believe it's been 20 years or more.
I know. Yeah. It's terrible.
No, but that was a good magazine. And you had Cindy Crawford on the cover of the first.
That's right. That's right. I mean, the interesting thing is you had to do these things with the covers to get people to notice it on the newsstand, let's say, and also to tell them we're not trying to be elitist or, you know, some kind of exclusive club. Everyone's welcomed in. But the thing that's interesting is that when I look at where we are now, I mean, we were a post-partisan magazine and we covered Republicans and Democrats in the same pages, and that would have been really helpful right around now. You know, people would have a better view of what was unfolding.
Yeah, it is so strange the way the news media is in these two completely different camps, and therefore it's really hard to find truth.
Yeah.
And how was that in Lincoln's time? Did you find newspapers reflecting their political points of view when they reported the news?
Absolutely. I mean, they were more partisan, probably. I mean, there was it was kind of set up that way from the beginning, like a particular political person would start, you know, say the New York Times or, you know, the New York Herald or what have you. And then the view would be sort of threaded throughout. But people understood those partisanships. I mean, I would say, for example, there are certain newspapers now that are a lot less, you know, far less partisan. And so but people understood that, and they would probably, you know, read a few different papers so that they had a kind of larger view of what was going on. But it wasn't, it was more, yeah, definitely more partisan.
More partisan than now.
But yes, definitely. I mean, possible. For example, like the head of the New York Times at the time was, it was going into the re-election of Lincoln. He was about to go to his Republican nomination, and the owner and head of the paper was doing this massive book of Lincoln's speeches, his, you know, letters, and then the kind of history of him that was very laudatory. And, you know, there was no secret that he was pushing Lincoln for the presidency.
Huh. Yeah. So do you think the death of President Lincoln altered history's view of him significantly?
Well, I think it is interesting when you look at the fact that in a way his whole intention really was what he was going to do after the war. I mean, it was, you know, how the country was going to be reconstructed. So that denying him that part of his whole agenda really makes us have a different view and certainly send the country on a different track. I do think that the tragedy of him being assassinated makes people wary of looking at the entire record. And one thing that I did, you know, which was very noticeable when you're looking at his history, is that he was, you know, had troubling views on things like habeas corpus, the right to a free trial, that he would just suspend it very early in his presidency. It was not by any legal standard. There was really no justification. You couldn't say just because we were at war, the entire country should have that right suspended. And then, you know, my book deals a lot with his problems with freedom of speech and, you know, letting the free press have its run.
Right. Well, how did you find this story? I mean, I think there have been more books about Abraham Lincoln than almost anybody.
That's true.
So how did you find a story that hadn't been told already?
Well, I came across it when I was working on my book about the Statue of Liberty. And in the fundraising for that, this one newspaper, The World, was used. And the Joseph Pulitzer, who bought that paper, bought it at a cut rate price. And so I thought, well, why was it such a, you know, bargain? And it was because it had been so shamed by running this fake proclamation back in 1864 that, you know, it could never really recover. And I thought, well, that's a, you know, 20 years is a long time to be in shame. And then I read about Abraham Lincoln's response to it. And the thing that's so shocking is when the fake news runs, Abraham Lincoln responds by sending military into the newspaper offices and arresting the newspaper editors. And I thought, that's so different than anything I knew about him that I had to look into it further. And as you look into it further, it's such a complex, amazing sort of crime thriller story, because every time you think you come to the reason behind this whole action, there's some other, you know, larger story. So that just was too intriguing, you know, to leave aside. And so I think people have not really written about this because they get focused on the big issues of obviously the Civil War, the suffering and all that. And so to just tell a story that weaves through all the power centers of that time, I think it was unusual enough that I felt it justified working on it.
Well, for our listeners then, since you and I have both read the book, set the story for us.
So the story, basically, first you learn how Lincoln was always playing with the press. I mean, he himself would write anonymous letters to the newspapers. He would pose as other figures to critique his opponents. And he even at one point, leading into the 1860 election, bought a German newspaper in the middle of the country, knowing how important that vote was going to be for his success. And he had a secret contract that they couldn't reveal the ownership, but they could, they had to support the Republican platform. So he's a news, you know, he's in the fray of this kind of fight with the news. But what happens is on May 18th, 1864, there's a boy running through the streets of New York in the pitch dark at 3 a.m. and he's got this proclamation in his hands, and he's running from newspaper office to newspaper office delivering it. And everyone takes it to be something coming from the Associated Press. And so while all the editors were gone for the night, there were two presses that had foremen on duty running the papers, and they see it and they think, oh my goodness, we have to stop the press, put this in because it's from the president. And they put it in the paper, and the next day all hell breaks loose. Basically, you know, there's the stock exchange goes crazy. People are out in the streets, because what it is Abraham Lincoln saying the war is a disaster and he needs 400,000 men immediately. And, you know, if he doesn't get them as volunteers, he will start a draft. And so people were so fearful of sending more people down to the front that it was a nightmare. And there happened to be a boat going over to Europe that particular day, and it was leaving at noon. And if word went there, England and France would recognize the Confederacy likely, and that would just, you know, cause these two countries to be separated forever.
So the lie then is what?
Well, there's many lies in the book, and actually that's one thing that, you know, you keep coming across them. And so it's like, oh, was it when Abraham Lincoln lied that he was Rebecca writing the story, or was it when, you know, he lied about purchasing the newspaper, or, you know, and as you go through, there's different versions of this. And one of the, you know, I'll give you one of them, you know, there are more as the book unfolds. But one thing is that you find out after there's this huge crisis, and Abraham Lincoln goes into the biggest rage, you know, a witness said they'd ever seen him in his whole presidency. You suddenly realize that actually there was some sort of order for 300,000 men dated that exact same day. And now we can go into the archives and see that on that exact same day, Abraham Lincoln hand wrote an order for 300,000 men. He signed it, but he put it in his desk drawer and didn't send it. So then as you start to look at this, and his first response is after learning of this proclamation up in New York, you realize he actually thought it to be a leak from the White House, and his rage was about this betrayal. And so that becomes a very interesting sort of investigation. They have detectives on it. You know, the military is involved in trying to track down what happened. And so it takes you through these paths, through the media, through Wall Street, you know, and all the way down to D.C.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. And we're talking this week with Elizabeth Mitchell. She's the author of several books, including The Fearless Mrs. Goodwin, How New York's First Female Police Detective Cracked the Crime of the Century, Liberty's Torch, The Great Adventure to Build the Statue of Liberty, The Fire Horse, Three Strides Before the Wire, The Dark and Beautiful World of Horse Racing, and other books. Her new book is called Lincoln's Lie, A True Civil War Caper Through Fake News, Wall Street, and the White House. And we'll continue our conversation with Elizabeth Mitchell right after this. I'm Gary Shapiro. You're listening to From the Bookshelf on KSCO.
A couple of the threads in your book that I find fascinating, the gold market. Can you enlighten us a little bit about what the whole gold market thing was about?
Yeah, I find this really fascinating because basically what you're looking at is the beginnings of problems that we will, you know, we still wrestle with today. Essentially what happened was gold had been the currency in the country and different coinage like that. But then Abraham Lincoln introduced the greenback, which was essentially the dollar. And at first it was redeemable. So after a certain amount of time, you could go to the bank and get your equivalent value in gold. But at the end of 1861, the Secretary of the Treasury told the public, actually, we can't do that anymore. You're just going to, it's going to be separated from gold value. And at that point, gold became a commodity, just traded on the market. And everyone became obsessed with buying and selling gold. It was the currency that could be used overseas. It paid taxes. It would always retain value, even if the Union collapsed. So if news came through of a Union victory, then the gold's value would drop because the greenback would be seen as possibly valuable. It would last, you know, as long as the country. But if the Confederates had a victory, then gold would soar because it would suggest that the Union was going to be over and you would no longer have any, you know, these papers would be worthless. So it was causing a massive crisis in the economy, and we were already spending $2.5 million a day in those dollars, in 1864 dollars. We also had all of these men at the front, you know, not working, not making anything towards the, you know, gross domestic product. And then the, and, you know, of course, also many lives lost. And then you also had this kind of profligate spending overseas by the rich in the US. And so gold was flooding out of the country. And so it was basically, when you look at the actual numbers, it's terrifying. I mean, we were basically dropping, you know, half the holdings of the country over the course of a few months in that spring.
It's pretty fascinating. And also, Mary Todd Lincoln is an interesting character in your
She sure is. Yeah. I mean, she's, you know, she appears to be brilliant. She's, you know, very opinionated, a good match for him in many ways, but she was also unstable and she was deeply insecure. So when she's coming to Washington, she has this terror that she's going to look at like a laughing stock because she's from the Midwest and she doesn't dress right and all those sorts of things. And so so she goes on these shopping sprees and they're way over, you know, the top. I mean, basically she's spending the amount on a shawl that, you know, someone would earn over a whole year. And so she keeps getting herself in deeper and deeper. And so that leaves her open to all kinds of, you know, bribery, conspiracy, et cetera.
Yeah. Pretty interesting. She had a tremendous amount of debt, it turns out.
Yes. A level of debt that we, you know, we get to know about now because we get access to these archives. But back then it was something she was trying desperately to keep secret, but there would be little glimpses of it in the newspapers. And we know from, you know, the memoir of one of the women who worked with her, that she was in constant terror that she was going to be exposed, and also that her husband's enemies would use this against him, and that, you know, he would lose the presidency because of her.
I don't know what a dollar was worth exactly in 1864. So how much debt in modern money would she have been in?
Well, in the spring that I'm writing about, of 1864, the re-election year, the amount that just one of her creditors, you know, they have a letter going back and forth. It's more than his salary for the entire year. And yet she tells him that she's going to come up with it in a couple of weeks, which, you know, I mean, that can't be good, right? and also let's point out that Lincoln's salary at the time was fairly substantial. It was like the equivalent of buying 25,000 row houses in Philadelphia. So, you know, she was saying that in a few weeks she would be able to land that much money.
Well, did she, what did she spend her money on? Was she a shopaholic or what?
Yeah, she sadly was. I mean, she was, so there's a combination where you see her going on these sprees, these just binges, and it was a mania, I would say. But the other thing is, because she was known to have that problem, the White House would get bills for crazy purchases too, and it was almost impossible to know whether she had actually made the purchases, yeah, or if it was just someone using that.
Oh gosh, that's a terrible thing.
I know. It's really terrible. And I mean, I think that one thing that I found very touching and in the book is him trying to negotiate how to handle her instability. And he is he's so worried about her much of the time, and partly too, because they suffered these horrible tragedies. They lost two sons, one of whom died while they were in the White House. And he's so fear, you know, he asks for advice from one of his friends about what to do with her, you know, given her instability. And they say, just try to approach her with kindness and firmness. And at one point she's so racked with grief about the death of their son. She can't really recover, and she's almost hallucinatory, hallucinating in the White House. And he at one point takes her to the window and points to the asylum down the way. And he says, I want you to try to figure out a way to come to grips with this, because otherwise, we're going to have to put you, have you go there.
And I believe at some point she was institutionalized, wasn't she?
Yes, she was. I mean, there's a whole, tragedy that's after the time of this book, which is, after Abraham Lincoln has been killed, and, she's lived out some years trying to deal with her debts that still linger, and, a lot of pain and tension around that. Her son actually tries to commit her. And there's a whole trial with transcripts that are quite fascinating to read, because sometimes, there seems to be a good case to be made that she needs some serious help. But on the other hand, sometimes she just sounds like a really smart woman who's, thrashing against the kind of power dynamics of the time.
It sounds like subject of a good book for you.
I know. You see how people get, hooked into it. I was talking to a friend of mine who wrote a book about Lincoln recently, and we were saying, we always thought that the Lincoln people, like, why did they get, keep writing about him over and over throughout their career? But you sort of see why, because it's just the complexity of him and his administration and the time and what it means to us today is so.
There's a lot of rabbit holes.
Yeah.
Well, I think one of the most tragic aspects of Mary Todd Lincoln, not only that she lost her children and her husband, but when her husband was dying, I guess it was Lincoln's cabinet basically put her in another room and said, he'll be fine. And, mm-hmm. and didn't allow her to be with him when he was dying, which was a wife's job, right?
And they were very close. I mean, that comes across in my research in all sorts of ways, everything from, memoirs to letters to newspaper accounts of their interactions. I mean, this was not a distant marriage. They were entwined. So it's just really sad that she was treated in that way frequently, I would say.
So during his lifetime as well.
Yeah, because there were some really, I find, annoying traditions that put her in a state of deep insecurity. For example, when there would be a formal dinner, often it wasn't the first lady who walked in with the president. They would just pick some, pretty young thing to walk in with him. And that was the tradition. So she was often feeling, separated from this person who she was so connected to.
Well, it's interesting. I think in Lincoln's Lie, your book, Lincoln himself is kind of off stage most of the book.
Yeah, he comes in and out, but I think that I tried to think about him. It's so hard to write about him where you're not thinking of him in his, iconic form and trying to get to the humanity of him. But I found there was this one small thing that really helped me, which was that at one point, one of the telegraph operators who he's friends with says that when he was listening to a story, and he was a great listener, he would often break into this huge grin, and then he would run his hands through his hair and have them have it stand up on end like an electric doll. And I thought, okay, now I can see it, because he's so quirky in many ways, his jokes and his some of his weird, parables he tells people and things like that. But that particular gesture seemed to me to point to this kind of, how unusual he was as a human.
The book is called Lincoln's Lie, A True Civil War Caper Through Fake News, Wall Street, and the White House. The author is my guest, Elizabeth Mitchell. And Elizabeth Mitchell, you've written quite a bit about horses as well, a couple of books about
That's
horses.
Right, yes.
What's your connection to horses? Do you ride?
I mean, I took a few lessons, but really my first major connection to horses was going to the Kentucky Derby in 1999 and having a pretty magical experience there. And so going to that race under the circumstances I did, and then seeing that particularly dramatic Kentucky Derby, which was with Chris Antley on the very, much a long shot horse, Charismatic, got me hooked. And I had been writing about politics. And so suddenly looking at that horse racing world where everybody will tell you everything. You can go around and do an interview and everyone will, you know, tell you their views on life, you know, everything that happened to them and such. I got fascinated by it and wanted to tell the story of that particularly dramatic year. So you're a fan?
I am a big fan of, well, I ride, but I'm also a fan of horse racing. I love horse racing. And even this year, which has been a strange year, has been an interesting year for the sport.
Yes, very. That was an interesting book to report to, because I spent, you know, the better part of a year traveling around the country, going to track to track to find my different sources and, you know, interview people. But at one point I got so deep into it that I went to one of the top breeding farms in Lexington, Kentucky. And this one guy showed me around the whole breeding farm. And then later that night, he called my hotel and said, actually, there's two foals that will be born tonight. Do you want to come see that happen? So I ended up going there and helping pull a thoroughbred out of, you know, the mother, you know, under the full moon, which apparently is good for birthing horses. And it was really extraordinary. So, yeah.
And then 3 years later, that horse won the Kentucky Derby.
I kept following that horse, and it had a really good lineage, but sadly it didn't do remarkably well, but its few victories, I was, you know, I felt like a proud mother or something.
That's exciting. What stable was that?
That was Claiborne.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah.
Those are some beautiful, beautiful places.
Yeah, no, extraordinarily beautiful. I was going to say, once you get hooked in that world, it's, you just, you know, you can't get enough. So that there were also things like, I don't know if you've ever done this, but go for breakfast at the track. And that usually there's one place that gives you coffee and you can get an egg sandwich or something. And you watch everybody coming through the dawn, you know, the darkness of dawn and the mist and all that. And it's just amazing.
I did breakfast at Saratoga once, which was really
nice.
Yeah, it was really fun. When we were touring in Kentucky, we went to some of the farms there. And I asked the guy who was showing us around, I said, what are these little shacks over here? And he goes, oh, those, we use them as storage, but they're the former slave quarters.
Yeah, no, it's, I mean, that's definitely part of that past. And actually, you know, what's interesting is that I don't know if you've seen this, but that originally horse racing, you know, was, the jockeys were primarily, you know, Black Americans, but then everyone realized they were making a lot of money. And so then they were expelled from the sport. And so you're just like, this is incredible, you know? So, and then it took, you know, it evolved into, for the longest time, into this very, you know, white bred sport. It has a very complicated history, like most of America, I guess.
Yeah. And the Civil War is not such distant past when you're, when you're there looking around.
Yeah. I mean, it's not actually, I mean, there's a comedian who, you know, who said it's basically two 75-year-old ladies back to back, you know, I mean, we're not that far from that history, 150, you know, a little over 150 years. So, it's just that, yes, there you see it much more clearly, I would say.
And it really feels very fresh when you're reading your book, because your book is, as I was saying, it's investigative reporting. Lincoln's Lie, A True Civil War Caper Through Fake News, Wall Street and the White House. And the author, my guest, Elizabeth Mitchell, thank you so much for chatting with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much for having me.
Elizabeth Mitchell. I think you'll find all of her books to be fascinating, in addition to her new book, Lincoln's Lie. She's also the author of The Fearless Mrs. Goodwin, How New York's First Female Police Detective Cracked the Crime of the Century, Liberty's Torch, The Great Adventure to Build the Statue of Liberty, Three Strides Before the Wire, The Dark and Beautiful World of Horse Racing, and lots of other books. I'm Gary Shapiro. You're listening to From the Bookshelf on KSCO.
It's a pleasure to welcome From the Bookshelf contributor Lissa Warren back to the show. Lissa is in the book business and always brings me some of the best authors that you hear here on From the Bookshelf. But I don't always get to do all of the books that she sends my way. So I thought I would invite her to come by this week and tell us some of the books that I've missed. So Lissa, what have you been reading?
So
So right now I'm reading a wonderful book called This Is Your Brain on Food. And the subtitle is An Indispensable Guide to the Surprising Foods That Fight Depression, Anxiety, PTSD, OCD, ADHD, and more. She covers all the bases. Her name is Dr. Uma Naidu, and she is a nutritional psychiatrist at Harvard Medical School. I didn't even know there was such a thing as a nutritional psychiatrist, but it turns out there is. And she is also the director of the Lifestyle and Psychiatry Department at Mass General Hospital, which is, you know, quite a high-end, really, really good hospital here in the Boston area where I live.
So there's been a lot of diet and nutrition books out there. So what's the story with this one? Why is it a good one?
I like it because it's not about losing weight, and it's not even just about physical health. What it really focuses on is mental health and the various foods that we can eat to help our own mental health. And the thing that makes it really cool is this lady is kind of a triple threat. In addition to being a psychiatrist and a nutritionist, she's also a trained chef. So when she advises you, try this food and try that food, she tells you, you know, put this spice in it, like add some turmeric or add some cayenne pepper. And those things will reduce inflammation, which is good for you and good for your brain, but they also taste really good. So she knows of what she speaks. It's really cool.
And I guess this is a good time for this book, more than, say, a year ago.
Yeah, there are so many mental health issues that are on the rise right now because of COVID, things like depression, anxiety, and insomnia. And this book addresses each of those head on and tells you, you know, try this food for this and try this food for that. We need that advice right now. You know, we don't want everybody turning to medication if they don't need it, but she's good about that too. She does say, you know, blueberries are not going to save everyone from everything. Like if you're having a serious mental health issue, yes, food can help you, but you should also consult a medical professional who may want to put you on medication. You know, she's not crazy about the idea of people not seeking medical help if they really, really need medical help.
Well, that sounds like a good one. Is there like one little thing from the book you could say, oh, we could do this right away?
Yes, we should all be having breakfast for dinner if we are having trouble sleeping. And the reason for that is there's a lot of melatonin in eggs, and melatonin helps you fall asleep. So if you make an omelet for dinner or you make yourself a frittata, you're going to be doing yourself a favor. And in her book, she also mentions some vegetables that you can throw into it that will also have beneficial mental health effects.
I love breakfast for dinner. It's one of my favorite things.
It's an easy fix. It's something easy to do. She's very practical.
What about in the history department? What are you reading there?
Right now I'm reading a book called Damaged Heritage, and it's subtitled The Elaine Race Massacre and a Story of Reconciliation. It's published by Pegasus Books, and the author is J. Chester Johnson, who grew up in the South but lives in New York City now.
And what's the story? I don't know. I've never heard of the Elaine Race Massacre.
I have to confess that I had never heard of the Elaine Race Massacre either. And, you know, that's one of the reasons I love books. You get to read about stuff that you never even were exposed to during your public school education, or at least my public school education. It is about a massacre that took place in 1919 in Arkansas along the Mississippi River Delta. And it was arguably the worst racially motivated incident in United States history. So it really is wrong that many of us have never even heard of it, or we've heard of it but don't know much about it. But that's the focus of the entire book.
And how did the author get involved with the book?
Well, here's a crazy story. When he was a little boy, he was kind of mostly raised by his grandfather, and his grandfather was someone he idolized. It was his beloved grandfather. And as he grew older and started hearing some family stories, he came to realize that his grandfather was in some way, shape, or form part of this Elaine Race Massacre. And his grandfather was white, and it was a, you know, massacre of Black people. So as Chester grew older, he wanted to know more, and he wanted to learn more about it. And in his research, he found that his grandfather had played, you know, probably a pretty bad role in this massacre. And so Chester, who really doesn't have like a racist bone in his body, had to come to terms with this, the memory of this wonderful, loving grandfather who kind of made him many of the wonderful things that he is as an adult, that Chester is, and this person who perpetrated a terrible crime on people many years ago.
So there are really two reconciliations going on in the book.
Yeah, there's his reconciliation with his grandfather. I mean, his memory of his grandfather. His grandfather's no longer with us. But it also is very much about racial reconciliation. And Chester tries to point the way forward for how Black people and white people can, you know, get along better and, you know, forgive each other. Honestly, he feels that a lot of the reason that white people and Black people don't get along is that white people can't forgive themselves for things that they or their ancestors have done. That Black people are actually, in many cases, more willing to forgive white people for those things than white people are willing to forgive themselves. And one of the things that I love about this book is the foreword is written by a woman named Sheila Walker, who Chester befriended in adulthood. And she also had family members that were involved in the massacre, except they were the ones who were, you know, harmed in the massacre. And she and Chester became very close friends, and she agreed to write the foreword to this book. So their relationship also sort of suggests a reconciliation, and it's almost a third reconciliation, I guess, in a way.
Wow. Damaged heritage. That sounds like a good one. What else you got?
So I thought I should save something fun for the end here. It's a thriller set in Las Vegas. It's by a guy named David Albertine. He's a young writer. He's based in Canada, and the book is called Undercard. And of course, not being much of a sports buff, I know that probably shocks you to hear that, Gary, but I'm not much of a sports buff. I had to do a little research and make sure that I really understood what was going on in the book. And Undercard is a boxing match that is not the big match of the night. It's sort of the starter match. And now I know that, and I feel so much smarter for it. But even if you're not a huge boxing fan, it's a great novel. It's about four childhood friends who, as they grow into adulthood, work hard to remain friends. And one of them commits a crime, and the others have to come to terms with that, which is especially hard for one of them to do because he is a police officer.
Oh, that sounds like a twisty one. Is there, we don't want to give anything away, but is there like the coolest thing about the book that got to you?
The thing that I like about it the most is a very writerly thing. And that is the fact that the entire book, all of the action that takes place in it, takes place in one 24-hour period. And consequently, it moves fast. The plot is quick. I double dog dare you to try to not read this book in one sitting. You will not be able to put it down. People say that all the time, but you really are going to want to just keep going to find out how it ends. It's almost like one of those conveyor belts at the airport where you step on it and you can't get off it until the very end. That's Undercard by David Albertine.
Well, those all sound great. Just tell us the titles of them one more time.
Sure, you bet. This Is Your Brain on Food, Damaged Heritage, and Undercard.
Lisa Warren, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. Come back and tell us some more books soon.
You know I will. Take care.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.